tonight on Arena. Eavan McGinity on her role in the new Irish film The Edge of Chaos, and Natalie Haynes on the reclaiming of the female characters of Greek mythology. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The Cork Film Festival continues until Sunday, November the 15th. One of the many Irish films to be premiered at the festival is the second feature from Irish director Sam Ullman. The film focuses on the troubled Carrie Keenan, played by Eavan McGinity, and her dysfunctional relationship with her family, principally her businessman and aspiring politician father, Derek Keenan, played by Sean Mahan. Joining me on the line, he's from Amsterdam, I believe, this afternoon, or this evening rather, is Eavan McGinity, along with director Sam Ullman, who's with me in studio here in Dublin. I have to ask you, first of all, Eavan, I don't know if you heard all those comments at the end of Drive Time about the accents in Wild Mountain Time. Have you seen the trailer, and what did you think?
Hi, how are you? Yes, I've seen the trailer. Like, I haven't been under a rock. I came home yesterday and I got my friend sent it to me. And then I met the rest of the cast after we finished work, and the first thing they did was show it to me as well. So it's definitely the talk of the town, you know, top of the morning.
And come here now, you're from the same part of the world as me, County Monaghan. And you know, that much, in parts of it, in fact, probably further north than County Down and poor old Jamie Dorn. Do you find it hard to drop your accent a couple of 20 or 30 miles down in and around Mullingar in the Midlands? Or do you find yourself going off into Shirin Bigara land very quickly?
No, I like doing accents. Like, I think it's important for me, because I think my accent is probably quite strong, but it's important for me to do it. But I definitely don't want to start slating. You know, it's everybody's each their own. And we can't really judge fully on... It's only a trailer we've seen, so, you know, we don't want to be too harsh.
Okay.
I'm being very diplomatic.
You have to be very, very diplomatic. That maybe
very
is that, that,
kind.
That's the touch of the border county in you now. You need to be diplomatic when you're from up that part of the country. No diplomacy from you, Sam Ullman, sitting in front of you. You saw the trailer too, Sam, I presume.
I did, yeah. I wasn't sure to laugh or cry, to be honest with you. But I think it looks great, yeah. Christopher Walken doing an Irish accent, I think that's just what we need to get us through COVID anyway, so...
Well, of course, it could be what they could do is replay that accent over and over in lockdown.
Exactly.
Now, that'd be punishment for you.
However, I'm sure it's been talked about.
Everyone is going to watch it.
Exactly. I'm definitely going to watch it anyway.
No such thing as bad publicity. my producer this evening said it'll be a cult movie within whatever, a year.
Absolutely.
Probably.
Can't wait.
And sure, look, live and let live, as you say, Eavan, and I'm sure we'll be hearing lots about it. I hope we get to review it at some point along the way. All right. Let us turn our minds to the film that you're here to talk about this evening, which is The Edge of Chaos. Tell us a little bit about your character, Carrie, and where she fits into this story, first of all, Eavan.
Well, I guess it's about her relationship, or lack thereof, really, with herself, her family, and without going too hippy-dippy, like zero self-love from a life of... really dark secrets that probably could have been avoided in a way, like not what happened to her, but the secret itself, I think, is what actually started to rot inside her. Do you know what I mean? And therefore she has this really bad addiction, and it's tearing everything apart. Somehow she still maintains a really strong work ethic, and that's great for her in a way, but it's also not, because it's another, it's just another addiction. I think it's just another way that she loses herself. And you get to see all these different dynamics and where everything just sort of comes to a head between her and her husband, her and her father particularly, which is really hard, I think. I haven't actually seen it yet, but it was definitely hard to go there on the day, to go to that level of, I don't want to say hatred, but it was It was pretty dark and heavy.
Yeah, well, let's listen to a clip, in fact, between Carrie, played by yourself, Avian, and the father, Derek Mahon, Derek Keenan, played by Sean Mahon. And this is seen quite early on in the movie, actually, and he's just come from a kind of a big launch where he's received an award for being the nicest guy in the world. But, of course, we have a hint that maybe he isn't the nicest guy in the world. And certainly Carrie has something on him. She has something up her sleeve. She wants control of the business, and she phones her dad afterwards, and this is how they speak to each other. They get quite annoyed with each other, I must warn you, before the end of this clip, and they don't hold back when it comes to expressing themselves linguistically in a very authentic accent, I would say.
It's definitely authentic.
Have you thought any more about my offer?
It's all I can think about. Look, I've had Billy on, he's worried sick.
I don't want another argument, I want an answer.
Okay, well then the answer is no. That's my company, I built it from nothing. What, you think I'm just gonna let you take control of it? The state you're in?
No, I am the one who's kept that company afloat while you went off to play politician. I mean, by right it should be my name above the door, not yours.
Well, it is my name, and until that changes, I decide how that company's run, you understand? Not you. Now look, I'm sick and tired of this. You just call me back when you've sobered up, okay?
Yeah, it's a nice headline in the paper today. Didn't think they'd run the story so quick.
Jesus Christ, Carrie, don't tell me you had something to do with that.
I wanted to get your attention, but it doesn't have to go any further. And if you don't give me what I want, I'll tell them everything. I mean, I'll show them the Redwood account.
Are you out of your fucking mind? Jesus Christ, I will not be blackmailed by my own daughter, do you understand?
I won't stop there. I'll sing if I have to. I'll let them know what kind of man you really are.
Jeez, Carrie, look, you are not thinking straight. Okay, look, I know we have our problems, but if you do this, this will destroy everything that we've worked for.
You have until the end of the day to make your decision. Otherwise, your corrupt deals will be very public very soon.
There you go, Avian McGinty as Carrie Keenan and Derek Keenan, played by Sean Mann, in the scene there from the film The Edge of Chaos. Avian speaking to us from Amsterdam this evening, and the writer and director, Sam Ullman, with me in studio here in Dublin. Sam, we get... From very early on, we get the idea that there is a little bit of friction in this family, to say the very least. But there's a lot going on here. There's what Avian mentioned to us about her, as in Carrie's addiction issues around alcohol, around work, around lots of things, it might be said. There's the buried secret, which is a very a big trope in Irish yes, stories, yeah, really, and in Irish families quite often. We're also dealing with the corrupt politician or the corrupt would-be politician and planning laws and all of the rest of it, all of those dynamics and others at play. Was there one or other of any of those stories that was rising to the fore, that was the starting point for you in the telling of this story?
Well, I suppose it started with trying to look at just the roots of addiction, really, and where and how someone can kind of fall into that position. And then also along with that, it was just trying to focus on, you know, addiction through the lens of the family unit and not just from the alcoholic's perspective. And I think that's really what kind of grabbed me about the story originally, was just for every addict out there, really, there's just people who are surrounding them. There's family members and friends who have to deal with it. So that's really the root of it and where it came from.
Did you work in that area? Did you volunteer in and around that area?
I did. I kind of worked for a helpline for about 2 years, one night a week, just kind of... It was an organization that would deal with people who are kind of dealing with alcoholics in their lives. Mm. So people would ring up and just look for support and advice. And yeah, so for, you know, one night a week for 2 years, I was just listening to people. And, you know, I mean, I think on average, I was getting about 3 to 5 phone calls a night. And I'm pretty sure I never got the same phone call twice, to be honest. So it just shows you how much it's such a big problem out there, really, to be honest.
Yeah, and as you say, everybody's story totally different. You're not saying that the story you're telling here is everybody's story. It's the one that you're telling. But it is, Avian, one of the interesting things about Carrie. How aware do you think she is of that, you know, the fallout in her birth family, if you like, you know, her brothers and sisters and her mother and father, but also in her own marriage? How aware is she of the damage that's been done by her addiction, and how do you play that?
I think she's buried her head in the sand. Like, she's in such a... she's got the blinkers on, basically. Mm. Like, I think whenever you're that knee deep in addiction. It's sort of, it's at the fore, it's like so strong. But I think she thinks she'll get away with it and that she's going to be okay. And that's also a bit of a mentality, I think, that she would have learned from her father. So she keeps tipping along and she thinks her husband won't actually leave her. And it starts to just spiral a little bit too far out of control. Mm. She starts getting caught. The intervention sends her really far over the edge. And I think that's whenever it's a bit of a tipping point, because then she sees herself that she can't stop even after that. You know, it's that bad. Yeah. And that, like, her mouth gets her into as much trouble as her addiction at that point, because like where she goes is so, it's so heavy. It's so hard. You know, it's so... I think she's aware, but she's amazing at burying. Yeah, and she has been, because she's carried that secret for
You'll be delighted to hear that Sam is nodding in total agreement with everything you're saying there. Yeah. I'm wondering, you know, clearly when you cast Eavin, you got exactly the right person for this particular role, Sam. Had you had a lot of these discussions around at the time of Eavin's reading of the script and that kind of take that she has there, which is quite interesting that, you know, she really does. She's great one at hiding everything that's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was really the great thing about Eavin coming on board. From the moment we kind of met, she just got it and she was on it. So yeah, we were really lucky that she came on board, and she did a really fantastic job. I just think we didn't have a huge amount of prep time, but there was a lot of kind of conversations around just where the character is coming into the story. But like I said, it was kind of Eavin just kind of had it from the moment we met.
Well, let's listen to a scene between Eavin again as Carrie Keenan. She's been out all night at this stage, and she's told her husband, Billy, by Des Carney, she's told him that, I was staying with my friend Emma last night. That's where I was. You know, I just thought it was better to stay there. And here's where the conversation goes then.
Emma called last night looking for you.
Okay. I did have a few drinks last night. I'm sorry. I didn't want to drive, obviously. So I stayed in a hotel. It's just the stress of this deal with Reed. I just needed some time to be on my own.
Jesus Christ, Carrie. Do you even care that I'm up all night waiting for you?
Don't be so dramatic, Billy. I mean, it was one night.
Not just one night. Look at me.
I know. I'm sorry. I have been trying. It's just the stress of this deal.
The stress of this deal. Give me a break, Carrie.
Okay, I need to take that, okay? Just 1 minute. What are you doing? That was really important, Billy.
So is this.
Jesus Christ, what do you want?
Carrie, I can't do this anymore.
Des Carney there as Billy and Eavin McGinnity as Carrie in Edge of Chaos, the film we're speaking about this evening. Yeah, she really does cover things up in that respect in the film there. But I'm wondering, you said to Eavin, did you, that you haven't had a chance to see it fully yet, because it's showing as part of the Cork Film Festival. You're not going to get to travel to it, obviously, A, because you're working, and B, because you probably couldn't travel anyway. When are you hoping to see it in full, or have you seen a rough cut?
Well, no, you can see it for a few nights. I think from last night till Friday, is it, Sam?
Yeah, till Friday, yeah.
Yeah, because I've got the link. So I was in too late last night, and then I was busy today, so I'm definitely going to watch it. But it's also not, like, incredibly easy watching yourself sometimes. So I will do it, though, because I'm very curious, obviously.
What are you doing in Amsterdam? What are you filming there at the moment, Eavin?
Filming a story about, like, the IRA... active service unit basically coming over here in the late 80s and sort of targeting off-duty British soldiers and all the involvement from, like, you know, it's all based on true stories and the involvement of the police and the IRA over here. So we've been filming that. We're actually nearly finished, and we've got through it so far, touch wood, without any coronavirus and all that, so that's good.
Has it been a peculiar type of shoot in that respect? You know, when we look at films like Edge of Chaos, we go, oh, there's a film that there's no mention of COVID, obviously, because it was well before any of that happened, and there's no worries about social distancing. Yeah. The filming of that you're doing at the moment, have there been many restrictions? Has it been difficult in that respect?
Well, the IRA are all wearing just balaclavas the whole time. No, no, it's they're really safe. It's good. You know, obviously each country has their own different rules, but we get tested all the time. So we're little pros at getting the thing stuck up our noses now. And, you know, everybody just keeps their distance. Everybody on set's wearing masks other than, you know, whenever you're shooting, obviously, like apart from the actors. Yeah. So, as I said, we're nearly there, and it's great that everybody's been safe. So, you know, but everything's closed as well, so it's kind of easy to keep away from people.
All right. You know? Okay. And you do know you're going to get an accent test when you come back, coming home through Dublin Airport. An accent or a COVID test. Both will be happening. Well, listen, enjoy the rest of the shoot there. And Sam, then it's running
Thank you. And
well done on the congrats on the movie. It's running through until Sunday, then Cork Film Fest.
It runs through until Sunday, yeah. You can catch it online.
Online, Cork Film Fest, filmfest.org, and you'll get all of the details online. As Sam said, the film is called The Edge of Chaos. Based in London, but originally from Waterford, Moncrief is the nom de plume of musician and singer Chris Breheny. When we spoke to him in Arena in August, he just released his single Play Loud, a tirade against the mess that the world is in, sung from the perspective of young people who have had to inherit that self-same world, or will have to inherit it. That theme is followed to some extent in his current single, released today. It's called America. Moncrief there with a track called America, taken from his forthcoming EP out on November the 27th, and that EP is called The Class of 2020. Here in Ireland, through the work of playwright Marina Carr, poet Yvonne Boland and others, we've become aware that there's a battle going on to reclaim many of the classical heroines of Greek myth from versions offered by writers such as Homer, Aeschylus, Euripides and Ovid. Natalie Haynes is also on that crusade, and her most recent book, Pandora's Jar, takes on the great classical writers and challenges their view of many of the famed female characters, Medea, Clytemnestra, Phaedra and others. And I'm delighted to be joined now by Natalie Haynes, who this weekend is taking part in the Classics Now Festival, The Future of the Past. And that festival begins this Friday. Some people listening will have said, as they listen to that, Natalie, did he just say Pandora's Jar?
Yeah, did he get it wrong? Should we tell him? Is this the time to tweet him? I think he'd enjoy it if we did. Hey, everyone, do it at once. Yeah, no, you're right, though. She doesn't have a box. Pandora has a jar, if she has anything at all, in some versions of her story in the ancient world. In the earlier version that we have from Hesiod, for example, in the Theogony, there's no mention of any kind of receptacle at all. In the longer version that we have in his Works and Days, then she arrives at the house of Epimetheus, whose wife she's to become, care of Zeus's plan, with a jar, but we're not told that it's hers, that she, you know, she was sort of delivered there like a parcel by the god Hermes. So perhaps he's the person that, or god, we should be a little bit more responsible. But she doesn't have any kind of box, right? And in ancient art, visual arts of Pandora, she's never shown with any receptacle at all. She's only ever shown in the act of being created, sculpted out of the ground by the god Hephaestus, because she's sculpted from clay. So she's always shown in the state of being created because she's our ancestor. Women are descended from Pandora and men are descended from Erichthonius, two separate clay-born figures, earth-bound figures. It's only when Erasmus gets hold of her story, the famous Dutch polymath, he translates the Greek word pithos, which means jar, into the Latin word pyxis, which means box. And within about 20 or 30 years, we start seeing paintings of her where instead of, you know, being a woman next to a jar, which is like all Greek jars, really narrow at the base, really fat at the top, really easy to knock over. Don't put the world's evils in there. Yeah. Suddenly it looks really, you know, malevolent because here she is having to open it, you know, it becomes a strong box really quickly. And so what happens to Pandora, who's an agent of change for the Greeks, is that she becomes the villain who spoils everything. She basically gets mapped onto the story of Eve from the Old Testament.
Yeah, there obviously, when you mention that she is the, I suppose, the first woman, and the other, the gentleman you mentioned, is the first man in question. Are there other parallels then to the biblical tale? Because the first thing that strikes me is, if there's no box, if there's no vessel, how did she get all these evil things that she's supposed to have foisted upon us all when she opened that non-existent box?
I don't know how to let you know this, but according to Theognis in his elegies, the jar is full of nice things, not bad things. And in some versions of her story, for example, one version told by Aesop of Fables fame, it's her husband Epimetheus who opens the jar and lets all the stuff out. And the thing that's retained in the jar, in every version of the story where there's a jar, is Elpis. And that's a word which is usually translated as hope, but it's not necessarily hope of a positive thing in Greek. It just means something closer to maybe expectation. Something's going to happen, but we don't know if it's bad or good. And even that makes it difficult. Is saving hope in the jar a good thing or a bad thing? Is Pandora keeping hope safe for us, or is she refusing to let it out into the world? It's a genuinely difficult question to answer. So, yeah, what happens is that Pandora's story just gets hijacked, really, by later writers. But for the ancient Greeks, Pandora is an agent of change rather than a villain.
And I think it's careful to point out that what you don't do in the book is that you suggest, oh, no, all of these women have been totally misunderstood all through history. They're all really crystal clean and sparkling white and perfect, and they never did anything wrong in their lives.
No, because quite a lot of them are quite murdery. I'm not going to lie to you. And actually, there's one woman, Penelope, who I wanted to reclaim sort of from that fate. I wanted to reclaim women like Clytemnestra, who famously murders her husband Agamemnon, or Medea, who famously kills her children to spite her husband, Jason. But I thought, in a way, being the perfect wife, which is how Penelope, the wife of Odysseus, is so often considered by male writers in the ancient world and later, that's sort of a trap as well. You know, it looks nice. Oh, yeah, she's perfect. But it's very, very quick to see in book 24 of the Odyssey, for example, Agamemnon says, from the underworld, so you can see why he might be complaining about his wife. He says, you know, you're so lucky, son of Laertes, he means Odysseus, because your wife has been really great and the gods will, you know, write a poem about her. Not like my wife! it's sort of 4 seconds, basically, between him praising Penelope. And then you realise what he's really doing, which is just finding another stick with which he can beat Clytemnestra. As I say, admittedly, we could have a little sympathy for him because he's currently dead by virtue of his wife having conspired with her boyfriend Aegisthus to have him murdered. But, you know, I think they're all different kind of incredible archetypal characters in Greek myth that then get kind of squashed into sometimes stereotypical characters by later writers, you know, bad wife, bad mother, perfect wife. And I thought, well, where's the fun in that? These characters are people. It would be more interesting to look at why they're people.
Well, let's go to Clytemnestra then, the ultimate bad wife, as you say, kills Agamemnon. And
certainly in Aegisthus, in Aeschylus' version, it's her. In other versions, for example, in Homer, it's Aegisthus, it's her boyfriend, which is less exciting in terms of bad wifeness.
Yeah, the boyfriend killing the husband isn't really that bad a story, is it, in some ways? The wife getting rid of the husband in order for the boyfriend to be all right and inside in the bed is a whole different ballgame.
And yet, of course, in Aeschylus' version, the most famous version of Clytemnestra killing her husband, she doesn't really, that doesn't seem to be her motive at all. She's doing it for revenge. And the revenge that she is taking on Agamemnon is because he murdered their daughter Iphigenia many years earlier in order to get a fair wind to sail to Troy. The Greeks, you know, one of the grimiest bits of the build-up to the Trojan War, the Greek forces mass at a place called Aulis, and they can't get a fair wind to sail. And so at that point, a priest named Calchas tells Agamemnon that he needs to sacrifice his daughter. And Iphigenia is sent for as though she were going to be married to Achilles. So she turns up, this sort of teenage girl, as we would perceive her, a woman of marriageable age, as an ancient Greek author would have her. Kore is the word in Greek, a maiden. And she turns up expecting to be married to the most famous, you know, exciting warrior that there is. And she finds herself about to be sacrificed by her father, who, by the way, tells his men to gag her so she can't curse him. It is an absolutely horrifying scene. And when you think about that version of her story, which is told with complete clarity and in all its horror by the old men chorus at the beginning of the play Agamemnon, then you think, well, yeah, actually, you can kind of see why Clytemnestra might nurse a grudge for 10 years.
You might see why she did what she did, but does it excuse it? Does it justify it? Is that what you're in the business of doing when you start to try to reclaim Clytemnestra in this book?
I don't think so. I don't think it's particularly a thing that we need from mythic characters to justify them. I think what we need them to do is ask questions of themselves and of us, and to look at how we try to resolve those questions. You know, the great question raised by Oedipus, for example, is not, is it all right to kill your father and marry your mother? It's, do we have free will or not? You know, he's destined to do these terrible things and he does them. So is there any such thing as free will? And it's a really difficult question that
yeah.
myth poses. And we're struggling. I would still struggle now to answer it, you know, on the strength of the tragedy of Sophocles. It's like, well, kind of more difficult. And I feel very much the same way about these female characters. I don't think they need my apologies for them, and they don't particularly have them. I just think we lose something really big from the myth.
And certainly,
to put them in a box marked villain, bad lady.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you do that with Clytemnestra, she's not a very interesting character. But if you look at her through the prism you've just suggested to us, she becomes a powerful person, a very strong person. Is there any basis for such a woman in Athenian society in suppose we're talking really 5 centuries before the Christian era?
Yeah, there's absolutely none. None at all. Athenian women and women in Athens in general, for they're not quite the same thing, have absolutely no power. You know, in the great funeral speech of Pericles after the first year of the war in 430 BCE, he says that the greatest glory of women is to not be talked about either with praise or blame. It's like, wow. So to be pretty well literally invisible then. Okay, great. If you'll excuse me, I'll just disapparate and reappear somewhere else. And that, in a way, is what's so extraordinary about this time in our collective past, is that at a point where women were completely, you know, their behavior was so limited, and essentially the richer you were, the more limited your social circle would be. Obviously, a woman who, you know, sells cabbages, who you might find as a character in an Aristophanes play, is going to have more social interaction than a woman who's cloistered, an upper class woman. But I guess that's what's so extraordinary about the Aeschylus version of Clytemnestra, is that she is gunning for political power. She uses the word kratos. We get our words democracy and, you know, and other such words from that. It means power, not just sort of figurative power, actual force. At one point, the chorus of old men who are so upset that she's killed Agamemnon, you know, try to challenge her. And she says, I'll fight you. She doesn't mean it metaphorically. She's prepared to take the, you're like, wait, what? And how extraordinary that this play and those Euripides plays like Medea, and like the Trojan women, like Hecabe or Hecuba, as some people prefer to call her, her Roman name, they're being written by men, performed by men in masks, because that's how Greek theatre worked. The word persona, of course, means mask, literally. Mm. And almost certainly at the theatre festival in Athens, the Dionysia, the audience was probably just men as well. And yet the opening monologue that Medea issues in Euripides' play of the same name was so extraordinary in its absolute demolition of the awfulness of women's lives that it was still being quoted at suffrage meetings just over 100 years ago.
So Euripides comes out of it okay, more or less, does he?
He does to me, yeah. I'm a huge cheerleader for him. I would get out pom-poms for Euripides, no kidding.
That's a Greek mythical image I can't get out of my head now for a while. Let's talk a bit about...
I can get that on a T-shirt, really.
I would wear pom-poms for Euripides. Medusa, I think you're in the process of, or maybe you've finished at this stage, writing a novel about Medusa.
Very much in the process of, very much not finished. Don't give my publishers ideas I can't possibly live up to. They're only going to cry.
Well, what did you learn about her in the writing of this non-fiction book then, Pandora's Jar, Women in Greek Myth? Did you learn stuff about her here that made you want to approach her fictionally?
Yes, I finished her chapter and I felt incredibly angry still on her behalf when I spoke about her to anybody who was stupid enough to ask how my book was going. And I realised that that kind of anger had to come from having a kind of unresolved relationship with her. It's like, I'm not done with this story yet. And to be honest, I felt that about quite a lot of the chapters, including some of the women I've already written books about. I was like, sweetheart, you've got to get over this. Like, yeah, good point. But when I got to Medusa's story, I had always, of course, you know, growing up, seen her in Clash of the Titans, the Ray Harryhausen movie with Harry Hamlin as Perseus going to decapitate this terrifying monster. And I had thought of her as that, as a terrifying monster. And it was only when I was, you know, a student, I think, that I realized that, you know, she wasn't. She was a woman, a mortal woman, although she has immortal siblings. And that's why Perseus goes for her rather than one of the others, because he wants a Gorgon head and she's the one who'll die if he decapitates her. It's pretty utilitarian. And she is she starts out her life as a beautiful young woman. In Ovid, she's described as a beautiful woman with a particularly beautiful hair. And then she is raped by Poseidon, the god of the sea. And that takes place, in some versions of the myth, that takes place in Athene's temple. And Athene punishes not Poseidon, who's too powerful, but Medusa. And she curses her and gives her the snakes for hair. That's the transformation that Ovid tells us about in the Metamorphoses. Yeah. And I thought, this must be the earliest example of a rape survivor or rape victim, depending on how you prefer to frame it, being literally monstered, literally turned into a monster. And as I was writing it, I thought, well, thank goodness we've stopped doing, no, wait a second. I was like, oh, okay, right, then I'm still angry about this, and this story needs to be told, I felt. So, yeah.
The extraordinary thing about the Athena part of that is that Athena abhorred the violation, but not the violation itself. It was the fact that the violation took place in her temple. It was her temple she was annoyed about.
Yeah, and she has form for that, of course. When the Trojan temples are overturned by Agamemnon's forces, then Cassandra is raped while clutching to a statue in a temple for sanctuary. And Athene punishes every single Greek except Odysseus, who she loves and forgives anything.
Before we go off Medusa, we should talk about, obviously, the statue of Medusa, the thing most people will know from many pictures. They may have seen it in the Vatican Museum. I don't know if they've been there, but it's the Antonio Canova statue of Perseus, triumphant, isn't it? He's there with his sword. He's holding the head in his hand. He said, look, I taught her a lesson. That got a couple of switches in recent times associated.
It's so interesting, isn't it? It's been a real... provocation, I think, because I've walked past that statue a bunch of times, and I'm sure you have too. You know, there's a copy in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. There are copies elsewhere. And, you know, it's a beautiful statue. He's a beautiful naked man holding up the monster's head. And I didn't think about it particularly, having walked past it lots of times, you know, in my little kind of bubble of thinking myself so very feminist and alert. And I walked past... I walked past it a bunch of times when I you know was on holiday or you know at a museum, and then 2 years ago, I'm sure you must remember Christine Blasey Ford giving her evidence to the Senate Judiciary Committee in America, and at that time, it's one of those memes that appeared, you know, as memes seem to. There's nothing, and then it's everywhere at once, and suddenly my social media timelines were full of this image of a gender switched version of Perseus and Medusa. So the statue is of a woman naked, a woman holding up a decapitated man's head. And in some versions of this meme, there was a text at the top of it next to her head. It said, be thankful, we just want equality. And then lower down next to his head, and not payback. And the first time I saw that meme, I gasped. I was like, oh, God, that's incredibly shocking. And then I took a moment and thought, why did you never feel like that all those times you saw the statue? And I didn't have an answer except that I was used to men being heroes and women being monsters. And I thought, okay, that's another reason why I've got to write a novel about Medusa next.
And the other version of that, I suppose, and that meme that you speak about there, in some ways was possibly a reaction to a meme from 2 years previously during the 2016 American presidential campaign, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Just explain the version of the statue we got there.
Yeah, that's a very difficult to look at statue. It's bronze, so it's gone that incredible kind of mottled green colour, of course. And again, it's Perseus in the book I call him repulsive at this point. He's in a repulsive, triumphant pose because he's holding up Medusa's head and he's standing on her decapitated body. And if you look at the statue from the front, the sole of her bare foot is facing us. It's so intimate and dreadful. You know, it looks like the corpse of a person because, of course, the awfulness of Medusa's curse is that she does look like a person except for this terrifying head of snakish hair. Sometimes she has wings, but, you know, we don't mind seeing wings on a beautiful woman because that's like an angel. Suddenly we realise that this is something really disturbing, and that's an image that was memed repeatedly in the 2016 US presidential elections because, of course, it showed a man in a position of victory over a woman who many people wanted to see as a monster, Hillary Clinton.
Let me finish up with the woman whose fault all of it is, it has to be said, at some point in the interview, because if you think of the Trojan Wars, it's all Helen's fault, isn't it?
It's all Helen's fault.
And you might explain, of course, it's not all Helen's fault, is the argument you're going to give right back at me correctly. But you might explain how Star Trek told the Helen of Troy story about a war between two planets. It was very thinly disguised as a version of the Trojan War, really, wasn't it?
I mean, I absolutely love original series Star Trek, not least because of the thinness of those disguises. But yes, of course, Helen isn't responsible for the Trojan War in all kinds of it. For a start, she's promised to Paris as a sort of prize by Aphrodite. So she has absolutely no say in the matter. Certainly that's true in Homer's version of her. She blames herself, but she's handed over by Aphrodite. You can't go around messing with Aphrodite. Even Zeus won't mess with Aphrodite because, you know, being cursed by her to love somebody who doesn't love you back is a generally poor day at the office. And so Helen is only sometimes Helen of Troy. On other versions of her story, which date back at least as far as Homer, she goes to Egypt and not to Troy, and the gods send a simulacrum of her. The word in Greek is eidolon, an image, and it's made out of air. It looks exactly like her, but it isn't her, and that is what goes to Troy. She stays blamelessly in Egypt for 10 years, but she's still derided as, you know, a terrible adulteress. And at the end of the war, the Greeks finally get their hands on what they believe to be Helen, and she disappears into the air that the gods made her from. If you're looking for a better metaphor, by the way, for the futility of war, I'm afraid I don't have one to hand, because that one's pretty much spot on. But when Star Trek takes this on, and it comes with all the caveats that obviously this was made in the 60s, and so the attitudes to things like Captain Kirk hitting a woman are not what they would be now. I'm not defending any of that, obviously. I'm merely registering that there's not much point judging people in the past for not being us. But Elan of Troyes is this incredible barbarian warrior woman. And the idea is that if she will marry this... we don't ever see him. We see his ambassador, who's extremely effete. So we're obviously meant to believe that she is the sort of tough warrior and he is a sort of very much more metropolitan, less warlike figure. And the idea is that this marriage will be an alliance, which means these two planets will no longer fight one another. And the Star Trek crew are there to sort of facilitate the marriage and make sure that she gets sort of from one planet to the other safely and in one piece and having been civilized. I did say it was a little bit, you know, dubious in the 60s etiquette, but there it is. And so that it, and then of course it's Captain Kirk who falls in love with her, and she falls in love with Captain Kirk, and he sees her cry, and it's like, oh, so he is the Paris figure, you know. So already this is interesting, because the marriage is ending a war, not starting a war, but now the marriage is in jeopardy because she's met somebody else, so he must be the adulterous figure. And then he sees her cry, and we're told that anyone who sees her tears is enslaved to her forever. And then right at the end of the episode, spoiler, I really am sorry, right at the end of the episode, we're told they finally have developed some sort of potion that will save him, an antidote to this incredible power. But it turns out he doesn't need it, because his one true love is, of course, the Enterprise, as any true Trek nerd could tell you. So he's, in fact, immune to Elan's power.
Surely, Natalie, somebody has said to you already, it's myth, Natalie, but not as we know it, regarding that episode of Star Trek.
I'm having two t-shirts made now. And that is the other one, yeah.
Natalie, lovely to have spoken with you this evening. That's it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Not at all, thank you. Natalie Haynes, and Natalie's book, Pandora's Jar. Yes, Pandora's Jar, Women in Greek Myths, is published by Picador. The event that Natalie is speaking about her book, Pandora's Jar, is The Classics Now, The Future of the Past. That festival begins on Friday, November the 13th, runs through until Sunday, November the 15th. Natalie will be on at 7:30 on Saturday evening, all of it online, booking on classicsnow.ie. Now, Mangrove, the first in British director Steve McQueen's Small Axe series, looks back at West London in the late 1960s, when the Metropolitan Police regularly harassed up the black residents without cause. The true story centres on Frank Critchlow, a Notting Hill restaurant owner who becomes involved in a high-profile court case of the time. Mary McGill has been looking at the first of the films, and she joins me now from Galway. I'm presuming it's where you are on this.
Indeed.
Is it as wet down there, Mary, as it is up here?
It's pure misery, Sean. It's all pure right. misery. You'll be delighted to know.
Okay, as long as we're all the same, that's good.
Indeed.
Now, Mangrove, I suppose we need to have an historical context for all of this, really, to understand. There are five films in the series that bring us from 1960 right through until 1980, but we start in the 60s with Mangrove and a very particular time in British history, in British political history.
Indeed, a very contentious time, Sean, very much so. The year is 1968, and we meet Frank Critchlow, who is an ambitious restaurateur. He's opening up his new business, and as he makes his way through the streets of West London, he passes by graffiti that says Powell for PM. And of course, this is a reference to the notorious Enoch Powell, who earlier on that year gave what has become his infamous speech known as the Rivers of Blood speech. And of course, this was notable for the way it complained and indeed was very alarmist about the role of mass emigration in British society. So that's the political background. We also have, you know, the issue with the police, which is foremost in Frank's mind because he's had a previous restaurant, the El Rio, that was very successful, across community successful, attracted, you know, white patrons and black patrons. But he suffered a lot of police harassment. So he's opening up the Mangrove. He's looking forward to a kind of clean slate, as it were, but things do not go according to plan.
Well, let's listen to a clip that gives us a sense of the way in which the police speak to Frank Critchlow in this film. It's Frank Critchlow, played by Sean Parks, Line of Duty, Small Island, Doctor Who, people might know him from, while PC Pulley here is played by Sam Spruill. And you'll get a sense of exactly how it was the police treated the community, the black community at the time. And needless to say, in their treatment of them, they also used plenty of colourful language to put the people down.
We set enough for lunch.
So how about sausage and egg then?
Yeah, the Mangrove don't do that kind of thing. It's just a spicy food, you know, for a particular palate. Irregardless, you have to book to each other.
What, with this?
No, with our reservation book.
Do I have to spell it out?
No, I understand enough. I met many a hustler, Constable.
What did you just call me?
I call you Constable, maybe as an officer now.
I'll arrest you right now, you black bastard.
Arrest me for what?
I haven't forgotten your antics at your last shithole, the Rio. Degenerates. Illegal gambling.
This is a
Ponces.
New business.
Nonsense.
It's a
different
kind of
late night queer parties, drug dealing.
I never
will shut you down
life.
Before you can say anything.
But I don't want no trouble.
Good company.
Leave the Mangrove alone.
Leave him alone.
Move
on,
Pulley.
Move your backside.
Move
from
on.
You
not got jobs to go to.
Get out of here, man.
Come on,
get out.
Move your backside.
The Mangrove is a restaurant. It serves West Indian cuisine to people who eat that kind of food. Just like any other restaurant. Greek, French, English, for that matter. We the Mangrove. We pay with taxes. We pay with bills and we pay with stuff. You gonna try and arrest me for that or what?
There we go. Sean Parks as the character of Frank Critchlow in Mangrove, which is the first of Steve McQueen's Small Axe series, which is looks back at West London, London of the late 1960s. Mary McGill have been looking at the series for us, are certainly seeing the first of the five films. And it is a film, it's film length. This, I think Steve McQueen's initial plan here, Mary, was to make a television series, which I guess would have been, whatever, an hour long maybe. But they're all, are they all feature film length?
Yes, they're all feature film length. And just, I mean, if Mangrove is anything to go by, I mean, Mangrove itself could have been just a television series. The richness of the material here really, really is something. And yes, I mean, there's clearly an incredible investment here from the BBC into this particular anthology. But I mean, Mangrove really sets the tone for that, in that this is, you know, an event that was, as we'll discuss, it was, you know, a pretty momentous one in terms of drawing people's attention to the issue of what we now call institutionalized racism. I mean, we just heard in that clip that you played there, Sean, from PC Pulley, Pulley the Bully, effectively.
Yeah.
And as I was watching him, I was like, this guy can't have been real. This is obviously a composite, to, you know, this is a villain character, you know, whatever. And I looked him up and he is entirely real. And, you know, it is shocking. You're just going, and you hear it in Frank's voice there. He's just trying to run a business. He's trying to get by. He's contributing to his community, and it's just not enough. And you find yourself, you know, he appeals to his local MP at one stage about the police harassment. He's told, but you've no proof. He appeals to the police about the harassment, and of course they don't take him seriously either. I mean, this is a man who, you know, when we meet him first, is not, it's not that he's not political, but he's a businessman. He wants to get on, but because of the situation that he finds himself in, he's really left with no recourse other than to really push back. And I think when we talk about a small axe, I think that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the symbolism of people trying to push back against this huge institutional power.
Yeah, I did ask actually about a small axe, and I'm very happy to tell you that my producer Roland McGowan immediately found out exactly what the small, where that comes from. The series title comes from a Jamaican proverb: if you are the big tree, we are the small axe. A reference here that, you know, relatively marginal, small voices of dissent can successfully challenge more powerful voices, or those in power, I guess, the center of the political system. And that's really where this story goes, because yes, it's a story of harassment, as we just heard in the clip that I played, but it develops from there into an actual court case. These are true stories.
Not all of the films are, but Mangrove is, and a couple of the other ones are as well. But it is, John, and it was a landmark case. It was known as the Mangrove Nine. So when the protest eventually took off, was organised against this harassment that Frank was experiencing, you know, a lot of the community came out, because again, this is actually, you know, I know we're talking about discrimination and everything else, but McQueen goes to a great extent to show that the closeness and the resilience and the vibrantness of this community in West London. So they come together, they protest the harassment. It leads to the organisers of the protest being charged with a new crime at the time, a very serious crime in relation to inciting rioting and a fray. To give you an idea of how serious the crime was, their trial was held in the Old Bailey. So there was a real sense that they were being made an example of.
Yeah, it wasn't the local circuit court or whatever.
No,
yeah.
Not at all. They were facing, if they were found guilty, a possible 10-year jail sentence. So this was really, really serious stuff.
And is this where Althea Jones LeQuant comes into the story?
Well, she's been there since the very beginning. She's a young student from Trinidad. She's over studying in the UK, but she's also a member of the British Black Panthers. Mm. So she when we meet her, she's one of those characters who's already, she has really strong political consciousness, you know, and she's kind of rallying those around her and rallying workers and so on. So she crosses paths with Frank, and she's one of the people who becomes part of the Mangrove Nine.
All right, well, let's listen to it. It's Althea Jones, Letitia Wright, rather, who plays the character of Althea Jones. And let's listen to her in that kind of, as you say, spurring on the masses, if you like.
Good afternoon. My name is Althea Jones. I'm a student studying biochemistry in this country. But today I am here as a member of the Black Panther movement. I've been invited here by your trade union to talk to you about your workers' rights and your power as a collective force. We have discovered and rediscovered the ways in which we can overcome the fragmentation our people have suffered throughout our history. And the way is through joining the struggle and being part of an organized struggle. For it is a struggle, actually, which makes us whole. So I've come here today to encourage you to actively support your trade union, because the virtue of lending your voice to collective bargaining is that together we become stronger.
And that's Letitia Wright as the character of Althea Jones there from Mangrove, which is the first of Steve McQueen's Small Axe series, or anthology is the way they're putting it, anthology of films that Mary McGill is speaking to us about this evening. It's interesting, Mary, I'm thinking back to what Natalie Haynes said to us about, you know, the victim shaming that went on in Greek mythology. And said, oh, of course, that's gone now. And she went, well, no, oh, it's not gone. It's the same thing we're talking, because you listen to this and you say, that's 1960s. Ah, but we're in 2020 now. From your viewing of Mangrove in particular, did you see parallels in today's society? I'm guessing you must have.
Absolutely. And I think that that is a theme that's going to run throughout these five films. Hugely, Sean. I mean, look at the summer that we've just had, you know, and the absolute tension both here and across the water between marginalised communities and the police force. Yes, I mean, those tensions are still there, are very much represented, and they're very much still real. But this is also a really optimistic story, because the Mangrove Nine were found not guilty by a majority white jury. And the judge that presided over the case was the first time on public record that somebody acknowledged that there was a problem with institutional racism right. in the British police. Mm. So the potential is always there for the story to change and for rights to be won and for things to progress. So it's a really hopeful story too.
And this is very much then the Steve McQueen of Hunger and 12 Years a Slave yes. that we're getting here. Any of the other, there are four other stories. Any particular ones that you're really looking forward to seeing or does it move between Britain and America, or is it all set in Britain?
It's all set in Britain. From what I can see, it's all set in London. I'm very much looking forward to watching Alex Wheatle. It's a story of Alex Wheatle as a writer. As a young person, he grew up in Care. He got caught up in the Brixton riots in 1981, ended up in jail. But there he fell in love with literature and reading, and from there progressed to become a really celebrated children's writer. So yes, I'm looking forward to watching that one.
Yeah, so five films in total, and the first of those that Mary McGill has been speaking to us about is called Mangrove. Small Axe Mangrove is how it's been billed. It starts on BBC One this Sunday evening, November the 15th. And as Mary said, it certainly merits viewing. And it sounds as if the next five Sundays in a row that we will get to see those five films will make for interesting Sunday evening television. That is our lot for this Wednesday evening here in Arena. Leah Murphy was the researcher this evening. Dermot O'Brien and Janice Furphy were the broadcast coordinators. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Olam McGann. Talk to you tomorrow night once again here on RT Radio 1.